This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under the radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth. A major piece of the Flint water crisis, which started in 2014, ended this week. While the people of Flint have not been made whole and there are still reverberating repercussions that the city will be feeling for possibly decades, the legal cases stemming from the crisis, at least the criminal cases, came to a shocking conclusion. Here with me to break it all down is Detroit News reporter Beth LeBlanc. Hi, Beth.
Hey, Shayna. Thanks for having me.
Beth, Attorney General Dana Nessel has ended the office's investigation and prosecution attempts of public officials this week with no one being held criminally responsible. What was the immediate reaction to this news?
Well, I think a lot of people saw it coming for the past year because there was a pretty definitive Supreme Court decision last year, but the Attorney General thought there was kind of some gray area where they could still pursue charges. And then the Supreme Court basically, with all the cases, said, no, you have to restart the prosecution in order to pursue these charges. When that press release came through saying this is the end of the road, I mean, there was a real sense of finality. I think for me as a reporter, even it seemed like, wow, it seemed very odd after 6 or 7 years of covering this to finally have it finish. But from Flint residents, I mean, there was incredible frustration. There was incredible outrage over the end of this, and yet not shock. I think because of the way things have developed over the past several years, they've seen a lot of ups and downs in the case. And so this was just another for them, but it was one that came with a lot of finality.
What reason did Nessel's office give for, as a statement from her office read, considering, quote, the Flint water prosecutions closed?
So essentially they said the Supreme Court decision left us no choice but to close the cases. So the Supreme Court last June ruled that the way that the Attorney General pursued charges against these defendants, so she used what's a one-judge grand jury, which is actually pretty rare in Michigan, but it has been used before successfully in other cases. But the Supreme Court, when these defendants appealed to them and said, listen, this judge, yeah, they can review the evidence, but they can't also indict us, and we deserve a preliminary examination. And the Supreme Court basically sided with the defendants and said, yeah, the law authorizes the judge to review this evidence, to make some conclusions on it, but the judge can't also indict them. And so it really kind of put a nail in the coffin of these cases in June of 2022. The Attorney General still felt there was kind of an avenue to pursue these, and she continued doing so. But then in the last month or so, the Supreme Court came forward on other appeals and said, no, you have to restart the prosecution if you're from scratch, if you're going to do this. So I think, you know, they said this was a result of the Supreme Court decision. I think also there are a lot of factors at play about that are preventing a prosecution from starting up again. One being the statute of limitations on many of these charges is 6 years. So it's been, you know, 7 years since the Flint water crisis kind of broke. So arguably the statute of limitations is done. So you can't charge people after that period. Another thing is that while the Attorney General was conducting this investigation, they uncovered documents that were privileged communication between state officials and the state officials' attorneys at the time, in particular during the Detroit bankruptcy case, that they had communications between that were protected because they were protected by attorney-client privilege. And Snyder and other defendants, they took this case to federal court and they said, these are privileged documents. You can't use these in an investigation. And the federal court agreed with them and said, yes, you can't. And in fact, now basically anybody who's seen these documents is tainted by seeing these documents. And so, long story short, in order to restart a prosecution, they would really have to go through which prosecutors had seen those documents and kind of weed through which ones were still able to pursue a prosecution at the end of the day. So that was a big obstacle as well, because it's, you know, it's possible they would need a whole another prosecution team to bring in order to pursue new charges. And so at the end of the day, they just said, we're closing the case.
Let's talk a little bit about the people that were indicted in 2021. There were 9 of them, and all of their charges have been dismissed. Talk about who sort of the big fish, if you will, were that were indicted and whose cases have now been dismissed.
Yeah, so there were 9 individuals who were indicted through the one-judge grand jury system under Nestle in January 2021. Those 9 officials encompass state and city officials. But, you know, the bigger ones that have basically led the defense on this case were Governor Rick Snyder, former health director Nick Lyon, and chief medical officer Eden Wells. Governor Snyder faced some misdemeanor charges in terms of like misconduct in office and everything. Nick Lyon and Eden Wells probably faced the most serious charges because they faced several counts of manslaughter related to the Flint water crisis. And then the others, you know, to varying degrees, some were charged with perjury, some were charged with misconduct in office. Others, you know, it kind of ran the gamut of what they'd been charged with, but there were several who were charged with felonies. They fought them pretty sufficiently and went to the Supreme Court a few different times in order to get those dismissed.
I feel like this is especially shocking because when Nestle took office in 2019, she just decided to completely start over with this investigation. Her predecessor, Bill Schuette, had charges filed for some people. He'd gotten some misdemeanor plea deals. And she said that Schuette's team hadn't pursued, quote, all available evidence. I guess in general, how is Nestle's office looking right now, given everything and all the resources that have been put into this?
I think Flint residents are upset. I think taxpayers are a little bit upset. I mean, so we recently, just last week, we went through all the costs of the legal costs alone related to the Flint water crisis. And there's been $60 million paid, spent on civil defense, criminal prosecution, criminal defense, because you have to provide lawyers for the state defendants who acted in their role as a state official. So there's been a lot of money spent on this, but also there's been a very human toll, I think, for the folks in Flint too. They've kind of been on a roller coaster over the past several years in watching this case develop. They saw a few different like plea deals under the Schuette administration. And there are rumors that Schuette's prosecution team was pursuing other charges at that time, that there might have been more to come out later. And then when those charges were dismissed, there were a lot of statements about this not being the end, about we have to pursue this. And in addition to pursuing other avenues, which the Attorney General's office wanted to do, they also believe that that Schuette had kind of farmed out the prosecution, I think is how they phrased it at one point, because they hired private lawyers to prosecute the case. As it turns out, once Nestle's prosecution team took over, they also had to do something similar, although they said it was led by in-office folks. But a lot of the attorneys within the Attorney General's office had been conflicted out because they were involved with the civil case. So there were, it's been quite a journey over the past several years. And at the end of the day, there are no felony convictions.
Are there any other open Flint water crisis cases, be it civil lawsuits? We know there's no more criminal cases, but are there any other open cases for the people of Flint?
Well, so, you know, the civil case is still, it was finalized this year. So the civil litigation, there were several class action lawsuits filed against the state. The state settled, and that settlement was finalized earlier this year. For $625 million. The state's portion of that was about $600 million. They are in the process of distributing that money. So that case is not necessarily closed because they still have to distribute a lot of the funds to different residents and to attorneys and everything like that. But other than that, I mean, to my knowledge, there aren't many out there still.
Let's move on to one more thing before we head out. Beth, you've been following the redistricting trial. In fact, we're recording this bright and early on Friday because you'll be back in court in about 20 minutes. This is a case that is contesting the legality of Michigan's voting maps, which were redrawn following the 2018 election when voters passed an initiative. And the main argument going on here is about race. Tell us just generally what's going on with the trial and what you've been seeing.
You know, if the devil is really in the details, redistricting is a bit of hell because there are a lot of details to this case. And so it's hard to summarize it all in just a little bit. But what I will say is that when the redistricting commission, when any state redistricts, there are certain federal and state laws that they have to follow regarding how those voting districts are drawn. And if there is evidence of polarized voting, racially polarized voting, so I guess to boil it down, if there's evidence that there are majority Black voting age population in a certain area, and there's white voters who are blocking those Black voters from electing their preferred candidates, then the districts, in order to be fair, have to be drawn so that Black voters have at least a chance to get their candidate through an election. So the redistricting commission, that is the case in Detroit. A lot of analysts have said, yes, there is racially polarized voting in Detroit, where you have, obviously a majority Black area in the city of Detroit and then whiter suburbs. And if you combine the two, sometimes the white vote in the suburbs blocks the Black candidate or the Black preferred candidate. So the redistricting commission, the plaintiff's argument is that the redistricting commission was supposed to draw these districts with a majority minority Black voting age population. So basically that Black voters had to make up a larger percentage of the voters in these districts than they currently are. And that because the redistricting commission drew them lower, these Black voters are not able to get their preferred candidates through. So it's a lot of discussion about demographics and population and what should have guided the commission and what did guide the commission and whether or not they gave Black voters a decent chance to get a preferred candidate through an election. The plaintiffs are saying that's not the case, that they've kind of crippled the ability of Black voters to elect a candidate of choice. The commission's lawyers are saying, no, we didn't do that. We were obligated by law. We had to undo past packing in the districts where they just forced a ton of Black voters into certain districts. And they've even mentioned the idea of redlining, that Black voters, because of a history of redlining, are illegally packed into these districts, and they had to combine them with white suburbs to kind of undo that. So there's a lot. I'm sure I'm not doing a decent job explaining it.
You're doing great.
There is a lot of really, really tough conversations that are being had, a lot of detailed data and analysis that is conflicting with each other in the courtroom right now. And at the end of the day, while it's very detailed, the effects will be pretty massive. So if the judges who are here today decide that these districts weren't drawn the way they were supposed to be, they can order them redrawn, which means it means there could be some big upsets in the Detroit area, because if they redraw them, they could redraw a candidate into a different district. They could redraw two candidates into the same district. So then two incumbents have to fight against each other for the district. And I mean, we're talking about, you know, people in high leadership positions. One of the challenged districts is the district of the Speaker of the House. And if they overturn that, what happens? Where does he run? Who does he run against? So there's a lot of big repercussions for a very detailed and difficult analysis that's being done in the federal courtroom right now.
And especially given that there's an election coming up in about a year. So if they overturn these maps, it's a lot of work to get done in a very short amount of time.
Yeah. And it's a lot on the line right now.
Beth LeBlanc, reporter for the Detroit News, thank you so much for joining me here today on Mishmash.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station. This episode was produced by myself, Shayna Roth, and Hearns Laguerre Jr. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. Our digital team is Dave Kim and Sophia Jasmiak, with additional help from Jack Philbrandt. As always, if you listen to this show and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you really, really like this show, you can support WDET. Just go to WDET.org/give. Without your support, really, shows like this one and all of the great work that WDET does just would not be possible. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.